Okay, this is tape number one, side one. Review of the tapes on the Amelia Earhart disappearance as interviewed by Elgin Long over a period of years. I'm reviewing all of the tapes and recording important parts of the tapes and making comments as I go along as I review the tapes. All of the information contained in this tape and in the following tapes in regards to the information, data, the actual interview itself, the recordings, are private and confidential and for only my own personal use. I intend to use these tapes in material for a book, magazine articles, television, radio, and moving pictures, in preparing stories, outlines, and various things for profit. So the use of these tapes or any information contained in these tapes, or any part or excerpt from these tapes, is private and confidential and not for anyone's use, no matter how they happen to come in to listen to any of these tapes or any part thereof. Anyone who listens to any parts of these tapes is expected to maintain the information so contained and the confidentiality thereof, and promises by the very act of taking time to listen to the tapes to do so. No information contained herein shall be used without the express written permission of Elgin M. Long. Okay, I'm going to be first reviewing the tapes that have to do with communications. These will be interviews that were done with William Galton, with Leo Bellarts, Thomas O'Hare, all three of whom were radio operators on the Itasca in July 1937, with other people like William Sutter, Captain William Sutter, who was communications officer of the Itasca at the time, Mr. Vernon Moore, who designed the radio receiver, the Bendix RA-1 that Amelia had on her airplane, which was installed just before her trip in March, with other people like Commander Anthony, who was communications section, Hawaiian's communications officer of the Hawaiian section at the time. He was a warrant officer in Honolulu and was in charge of the communications for the Hawaiian section. And other people who had something to do with the communications and the radio data that was so contained. Also, excerpts I will give out of the radio logs, both of position number one, which was the communications or high-speed circuit for intership to shore communications, and log number two, which is from the radio position 3105 and 6210, and was communicating mainly with the airplane, those logs. And also from the excerpts of radio communications that Commander Thompson submitted when the Itasca returned to Honolulu, 103-page report. Also excerpts from the battleship Colorado's report of the search, the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard report of the search, and also from the Lexington group, which was in the search later on, and from its report of the search. Also from the radio logs of the Coast Guard Hawaiian Section listening station, which was set up at the Aloha Tower, from the logs of the Pan American station at Keneohe, with excerpts also from the Pan American station at Midway and Wake Islands, and the other people who I've interviewed, my own personal thoughts. It'll all be contained, and I'll try and get down into a few minutes of tape, or a few hours of tape, I should say, the hundreds of hours of tapes and interviews and thousands of hours of study that I've done in these logs. So this is tape number one, side one, and this is what it's all about. I will be turning the recorder on and off, re-recording important parts of the interviews and making comments as I go along. This is for the purpose of putting down all of the information in a condensed form and also an opportunity for me to review all of the tapes. Okay, I'm starting out with an interview with William Galton, radio man third class on the Itasca, the United States Coast Guard, in June and July 1937. This tape was done on September 18, 1972, and I'm starting out with tape number 1A. I might also add that other sources of information that I have that I'm using is various letters and communications between Coast Guard headquarters and various radio logs and radio messages and various letters between Mr. Putnam and the Department of Interior, interviews with Admiral Black, and also interviews with other people who had to do with the communications, but there's many letters, many reports, many requests for information, newspaper reports that were contained from the New York Times, the New York Herald, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Examiner, the Oakland Tribune, the Honolulu Advertiser, and various other newspapers that came into my possession throughout the times, and also many things which were contained in the Amelia Earhart files at the library of the Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Many, 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 many sources. Those also will all be contained in the Thoughts on Communications.
And during the period from 1900 to midnight, the two radio logs form an accurate record of happenings. Okay. The Itasca checked the signal strength and frequency with San Francisco radio.
I wasn't there when I could have been there, but I forget if I was there, but I did hear the report that it was a good report as far as signal strength and accuracy of frequency.
Now it says here, key and voice were checked. No reply as to voice strength was received. The Howland Island log also forms a check. Signals were sent as agreed. San Francisco radio was obviously monitoring closely as told the task to slow to 10 words when the task was sending at 15, as Earhart indicated desire. All signals thereafter were sent at 10 words.
Okay, this is a direct conflict to the logs. In the first place, any time the key was used on the T-16, it would have been on 7,500 kilocycles. That's fine. And the signal strength in the T-16 was a powerful transmitter, and it would have been on continuous wave or CW transmission. And at 7,500 kilocycles, a good report from NMC would have been received. And they were sending the messages at a high rate of speed, and it is true, they heard them in 7,500, probably got a good signal strength. But the truth of the matter is, whenever they asked for a signal strength on the T-10 transmitter, which is a much lower power transmitter, that on CW, they were just got an S1, or barely perceptible signal, and in voice were not heard at all. There is no time that anyone said, while the Itasca was on the station at Howland Island, that they were hearing their signal strength on 3105 or hearing their voice transmissions on 3105 at all. As a matter of fact, the logs indicate in every case where they asked for a signal strength on voice, they were told that they weren't heard at all. And in the case of when they were using CW, they were barely perceptible. The matter of the fact is that the T-10 transmitter, which was used for the 3105, could only transmit up to approximately 4,100 kilocycles. Any time any frequency above that was used, it had to be the T16 transmitter, which was used for that purpose. And they could not transmit on the same time with both transmitters because they both shared the same antenna, and the antenna had to be switched from one transmitter to the other. And the T16 was a much more powerful transmitter, but it could not transmit voice. So all transmissions, it was only capable of CW, continuous wave transmissions. So all transmissions on 6210 or 7500 or anything above 4100 kilocycles had to be done on the T16 transmitter because it was the only transmitter on board capable of those higher frequencies, and it had to be CW because the T16 did not have voice capabilities. The intimation that the signal strength was being heard throughout the Pacific on 3105 kilocycles, which is the frequency and the voice communications, are the things that are in question. There is no case where they are shown to have good signal strength. The only person that has anything in the log, and we'll go into that in great detail later, is the DF log from Cipriani on shore, reports in his log that he heard the Itasca transmitting on 3105. But we'll go into that again much later. But as far as any place else in the Pacific Basin, the intimation that everybody was hearing them is in direct conflict to the logs.
Form an accurate record of happenings. Okay. The Itasca checked the signal strength and frequency with San Francisco radio.
I wasn't there when I could have been there, but I forget if I was there, but I did hear the report that it was a good report as far as signal strength and accuracy of frequency.
Now it says here, key and voice were checked. No reply as to voice strength was received. The Howland Island log also forms a check. Signals were sent as agreed. San Francisco radio was obviously monitoring closely as told Itasca to slow to 10 words when Itasca sending at 15, as Earhart indicated desire. All signals thereafter were sent at 10 words.
It could have been. I mean, 10 words and 15 words is a precise figure, and nothing was done on a piece of tape to beat it out to exactly 10 or 15 words, so it's a,
individual man's own meter of there. How it is.
Yeah.
Okay, then at 000 to 05, series of A's, please go ahead 3105 now. Go ahead. Nothing was heard. Now, transmission by voice and key on 3105 and 7500.
Now, I can remember, that the key was on 500 as well as 3105 and 7500, but I think voice was only on 3105. I can't remember, but it could be possible that voice was emitted on 6500. But for some reason or other, I want to favor the idea that there was only 3105.
I don't think you ever sent voice on 500.
Oh, no.
That's almost illegal. I mean,
it has been done, but surreptitiously.
Yeah. Because, any transmitter was designed for 500.
Yeah.
I don't think it would even have A3 capabilities, voice capabilities.
I'm in favor of what you say, in that chances are its emission was A1 and A2.
Okay, now, there's something else about this that's not quite right. If this is voice, you tell me how you send a series of A's on voice. I think this is a CW.
Transmission.
And even to the extent of the... Okay, of course you might write it this way.
Yeah.
She asked for them to send a series of A's. She didn't mean send A, 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 A. She meant send dip-da, dip-da, dip-da.
On A1.
Because she understood dip-da, and she understood da-dip. She asked the Ontario to send N's. So and she figured if I get the Ontario and the Itasca at the same time, I'll be able to tell which one it is by what they're sending, N's or A's. I know an N from an A.
Yeah.
Frankly, I don't know if she knew a P from an L, but she knew an N from an A. She asked very particularly in a message she sent, please don't send anything in code to me. And I think she was a little ashamed to admit that she wasn't the best code copier in the world.
Yeah.
And you know, it isn't easy to copy code. I mean, to copy 10 words a minute code means somebody's going to have to go to school for a month or so. And I just don't think she ever did. There with the asterisk, transmissions by voice and key on 3105 and 7500. Now, they intimate there that they can send on voice at 7500. But
I can't argue it, but I'm inclined to think that the voice was 3105 and the CW or A1 was on 7500.
And now it says here, the monitoring officers were Lieutenant Commander Baker,
the executive officer,
and Ensign Sutter,
the communications officer, as I remember.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean that he understood communications.
He was designated as his communications.
Yes.
And has some gold braid in the organization somewhere.
Exactly.
Correspondence of Associated and United Press present the entire night.
Now, I can't remember that. I do know that we were present later on after the flight was considered passé. In other nights, you know, but not for the whole night.
They didn't stay there the whole night, really.
But my memory doesn't go back to really say definitely. Because they're unauthorized people, you see, they're civilians, and actually they only have, as I see it, they have access to the radio room only by the commanding officer or the communications officer's permission. In other words, they can't just barge in.
I see. Do you remember that Lieutenant Commander Baker or Ensign Sutter was there all the time? One or the other or both? They weren't there all the time either.
After maybe 5 o'clock in the morning local time.
When things were hot.
Then they would alternate. When things were hot, they would come and go. But as far as staying in there en masse, I can't remember that.
Wasn't hardly that much room in the radio room for 4 extra people, was there, with 2 radio operators?
Well, you could squeeze 4 in there, but they would be in the way as you swung around to grab and change the transmitter settings to different frequencies.
Okay, then...
Yes, and it occurs to me also they would be in the way so that you could not monitor the output of the transmitter or watch the grid modulation, the grid current, as you would modulate. If those people were in the room, and they were in the room evidently in and out and later was hot, with that many people in the room, they would interfere with the operator's ability to turn around and monitor his transmitters. Also, of course, it would make the operators very nervous to have officers looking over their shoulders.
The actual weather available in the Itasca records submitted here due to link. The Senate on 7500 by key and on 3105 by voice. Now, isn't that interesting?
Now they pin it down to let you know, more or less, that 3105 is the voice frequency and that 7500 is the CW frequency. But I don't want to cloud the issue. But we weren't able to also transmit voice on 7500.
Now, it does get a little deeper in here. Itasca Communications duplicated each report and duplicated frequencies. Both voice and key were used in each broadcast and greatest precaution taken that no omission or error occurred on part of Coast Guard. Of course, they're trying to cover their tracks, but that...
See, the commander, too, is not... Is this the commander's summation?
Yes, more or less.
Yeah.
All the officers got together on the ship and put the... Bell Arts probably was in on this, too. However, they probably didn't filter down below Bell Arts.
Okay.
No, I mean, I don't know that he was in on it. He never signed it, but...
But well, anyway, the officers don't really know exactly, or at least they don't show that they know precisely what was done, except to make reference that 3105 used our voice and 7500 by key, because
they don't really know what you're doing anyway, do they?
In the total essence, no. And we have to be somewhere like for us that pinpoints every detail. And then that would have to go into this summary here in order for you to draw a correct picture.
Now, that's very interesting, because this is just about exactly what happened. And, of course, the T-16, which is General Electric transmitter, which was the only transmitter on the ship capable of transmitting on that frequency, was strictly a CW transmitter without voice capabilities, positively. And so we start to see here how the intimation of the information that was put into the report, which was held confidential for 35 years, got there. I should say probably got there.
And we have to do something like the arts that pinpoints every detail. And then that would have to go into this summary here in order for you to draw a correct picture.
There's a... They're blowing a little smoke, perhaps. They probably asked Bill Arts, did you put it on key and voice? And you, oh, yes, sir. You bet I did, sir. All right, well, anyway, it isn't important. That really isn't important. It might be, somebody wanted to make something out of it. It might be, but it really isn't. Now, the next thing here is at 0100 to 04, KHAQQ, Earhart, from NRUII, AAA, etc., NRUI, Howland, AAA, etc. Now, we both agree that's probably CW, but look what he says here. Voice used to duplicate except A's. Ask Earhart to use key in observing schedule. Now, he does say, like we both, how did he have to say A's? Well, maybe. Kind of interesting, isn't it?
But here's the thing. If you use voice and use this call, KHAQQ from NRUI, that's the equivalent of direction finder signals to so that a homing approach could be made on it. The AAA in this case would be superfluous if she can catch KHAQQ.
What you'd want to do is give her a long count of something, 1, 2, 3, 4, something like that.
And my thought is, if you hold the microphone button down, you can take a bearing on the carrier.
There's an interesting thing, see? You can take a bearing right on the carrier. Of course you could. All you have to do is put the beat frequency oscillator on, and in fact, that's the ideal thing to take a bearing on. Later on, we get into the direction finder logs on Howland Island. We can't understand the entry about why the bearing couldn't be taken. Interesting part of the tape here, it goes in the excerpts of the radio log show the same thing. They were sending the messages from 25 to 28 and 55 to 58, and the actual little weather sheet that the bridge sent down to the radio room, and these were special little sheets made up for the Earhart flight, of which we have copies of them, and they had instructions for this to be sent out at 25 minutes and 55 minutes after the hour. But very shortly after this in the logs, or when they first heard Earhart, or soon after they started hearing Earhart, she told them to transmit on 3105 on the hour and half hour. This was her understanding of when they would transmit. So she wouldn't have been listening unless by accident. The actual schedule was on the hour and half hour instead of 25 minutes and 55 minutes. And this was the understanding. However, these radio sheets, or weather sheets, which had little sheets of paper about 3 inches, 4 inches wide and about 6 or 7 inches long, had been made up previously, and actually contained right on the top of the sheet that they were being sent out at 25 and 55 was a mistake. The last understanding was that they would transmit on the hour and half hour. But Mr. Thompson, who was a radio man third class, who was on watch during the earlier part of the morning hours, had information hadn't filtered down to him, and he was transmitting them at 25 and 55. Later on, they corrected it to the half hour and on the hour, at least according to the logs. We're now reviewing side two of tape 1A.
Just to know for forecasting or predicting flood weather, at least at the destination. And the other person that came aboard with him, they came aboard as a group, Black and this lieutenant, and there was a motor machinist first class from the Navy who came aboard.
And he was an aircraft machinist specialist?
Aircraft, as I understood it. In those days, there was no special Eagle and Chevron's on it to designate.
Airedales.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
And as I remember, Mr. Black walked this alleged Navy experimental direction finder himself to the foot of the ladder, the gangway, I should say, and then the motor machinist himself offered to, and did take the take this direction finder up the gangplank to their weather deck, because I was up there and I saw the transaction or the operation.
This was in Honolulu just before departure.
I forget whether it was Honolulu or it was Pearl Harbor.
I see.
It could very well have been Pearl Harbor, because that would be the place where we would normally fit out just provisions and bunkers and things like that.
Yes, in fact, I can even tell you where you were tied up, Pearl. It's in the ship's logs and when these people came on board.
Yeah.
One other point I'd like to make ask at this point was that when the when Cipriani went ashore with the direction finder, there was an officer went ashore with him. I don't remember the officer's name.
Could it have been Ballard, Mr. Ballard's, the chief radioman himself?
I don't think so. Well, they had to make the Ballard's in the radio room from 2 o'clock on and working 3105 in this log. But we'll skip that for the moment. But, okay. Now, can we get back to this trying to
remember
how you got up and how you went on watch that morning?
If I got up and went to watch like I generally have in the last 35 years, I was largely asleep, and I went up the ladders at a slow pace, and I said, fine, I had to pick radio for a ladder ride.
When you get up all hours of the day and night.
But I got up there, and I did listen to what Mr. Thompson, the radioman, had to say.
Can you remember him talking to you?
Only in an offhanded way, in the respect that it sounded like he has heard a signal that could very well be Mrs. Putnam's signal, but he was unable to
identify
whether it was or not. But he said it was quite weak. I can remember that. And he did tell me why he was so late in calling me on watch. And I thanked him because I thought I was getting away with only a two-hour watch.
Excuse me, but it couldn't have been the bosun mate that woke you up, and it couldn't have been the wing watch that woke you up, because they wouldn't have known when to woke you up, would they? They would have woke you up 2 hours earlier.
Chances are, Radioman Thompson had already made the deal with whoever the watchstanders were, because normally, whenever a radioman is woken up, he double checks with the guy that's on watch to make sure he's waking up the right guy. Because if it was written on paper, maybe he's got the wrong paper, you know, for the wrong day. And I'm not saying that this did happen, but it could very easily have happened that when the if there was any checking done as to who was to be awakened, that maybe Mr. Thompson, the radio man, told him to hold off for a while, that he would give him a shout on the intercom, the holler, to the bridge, to have myself woken up. In other words, that's my conjecture.
Do you remember your bump?
I know that it was one of those bunks that
fold up
on its canvas bottom and had a straw, probably a straw mattress on it. And I don't think on that shift we had watchstanders' quarters. The only shift I think I was ever on that had watchstanders' quarters was the Tahoe, one of the sister ships of the Athabasca. Sure, and he could have, but I'm talking about the time I'm on my watch. Not because there's quite a few watches being stood in the course of the day, so by other guys. But I can't remember them having free access to the radio room at any.
They didn't just set their hour in and hour out then.
They had to stand up.
And they would go on and have breakfast.
There was only two chairs in the radio room.
Period?
Yeah, that's all.
Well, you relieved Mr. Thompson at 0200, you were expecting to go on at 2400, but he stood watch for two more hours because he was interested and he wasn't sleepy and he thought he'd give you a break.
As I remember it, that was way to monitor.
But
that was way to monitor.
But he was the only one in the radio room.
As I remember it.
There's not anybody else that came on watch at the same time.
Can't remember that. Though I do remember sometime later, after the sun was up.
The sun was up.
Yeah, that he was standing a watch on 6210 also.
So, what, do you remember who that was?
That could have been Mr. Hare, or it could have been it could also have been the chief radio man, Mr. Bullards.
But he didn't take over on 3105.
He didn't take the radio position that morning.
The upshot of all this conversation is that the report that Mr. Baker and Mr. Cooper and the Associated United Press representatives, Mr. Hanslick and Mr. Carey, were in the radio room during the entire night, according to Mr. Galton's memory, this was not true. People might have been in and out. He does remember after the sun came up and when things got hot, there were people in the radio room. But the intimation that they were standing there all night long is not corroborated by Mr. Galton's memory.
It's true that they could have brought chairs. It's possible they could have brought chairs from some other part of the ship to sit down. But it's highly unlikely.
That they would have been in the way as you tried to shift transmitters or anything like that.
Well, if they were standing, if there was more than four people in the room, chances are they would be in the way of changing frequencies and just, shall we say, disturbance of the regular watchstanders' operations.
Do you remember the room being full of smoke? There were a lot of people in there smoking. Did you smoke at the time? Yeah. You did smoke.
I smoked Bull Durham.
Bull Durham, rolled your own, huh?
It was the cheapest.
They did make a lot of money, though, too.
Yeah.
Well, then the second man didn't come on, and you 353, NMC and a task that checked on Earhart signals. So what does that mean?
Well, I'm sure that NMC could, if it's still nighttime, that NMC could hear. It's possible they could hear 3105, but it's really possible they could hear 6210 and 7500.
Well, they heard the Itasca on 3105, or I don't know what they mean, check on their heart signal. NMC and Itasca.
I don't know.
You don't remember any such entries. Well, that's in frenzy, so that isn't really part of your log.
The fact is that when they did check with NMC if they were hearing them on 3105, the answer was that they were not hearing them. It was not hearing them at all on voice, and only barely perceptible on key when they sent a series of V's for the check. However, later on, the NMC just said it's impossible, don't hear you at all.
I think. But I wouldn't have put a period after it.
How about if you have capital letters?
I doubt if I'd put a capital letter because...
You hardly ever went into the upper case,
did you? No, this was, if I remember right, like most ships, this had a Western Union type. You know, everything was capital.
Oh, I see. There was no such thing as small type and little type.
However, I have been on a few ships that had conventional type on their typewriter.
This is standard. Radio operators' typewriters were, as he mentioned, a Western Union type. And they did not have uppercase. They had numbers and only capital letters. I didn't mean to say they didn't have an uppercase, but they were not a standard typewriter where you used capitals. Everything was in capitals. At least that was standard in the Navy typewriters that I used when I was on radio watch, and of course that's what Mr. Galton intimated there. Okay, we're now going through tape 2A, William Galton interviews.
Atasca, Earhart calling Atasca. We must be on you, but cannot see you, but gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at altitude 1,000 feet. I'll stop right there for a second. Do you remember that message?
I remember a message, something like it. I rather think I recorded in the log it was 30 minutes of fuel remaining rather than gas is running low. I haven't seen the log.
They intimated in here to this point that this would be Bellart writing here, but they've put him up on the bridge.
Yeah.
Never have said that someone else came on. Okay, now, look what it says here. Other log.
Yeah.
Earhart, on now, says running out of gas. Only 1/2 hour left.
Now, I don't remember her saying the words running out of gas, precisely, or if she said it at all. But I rather think I copied on either 1/2 hour of gas left, or 30 minutes of gas remaining. But I can't recall gas is running low, and I can't recall the term running out of gas.
You do recall her saying only 30 minutes gas remaining.
That's what I think I recall. In other words, I'd have to see the log.
Was she coming in good and clear, as you recall?
Yes.
Good
and loud and clear.
Loud and clear.
In other words, it was on the radio speaker. Lieutenant Commander Tenner heard it.
Was he in the radio room at that time?
Yeah. And
he was the commanding officer of the Atasca up until the time you left Honolulu.
I think he was the commanding officer of the Atasca before up to leaving San Diego. Yeah. And also the executive officer, Lieutenant Commander E.H. Baker, was there, and I rather recall that he heard it precisely. And it could very well have been our communications officer that heard it. And it could very well have been Mr. Black himself that heard it.
The radio room was pretty full of people about then, huh?
Yep. But nobody sitting down except myself, and possibly, if there was another operator on the other side, he was sitting on it. See, you wouldn't have gone there. Unacknowledged.
Do you have any feeling, knowing that what kind of transmitter approximately she had on board, or at least whether he told you the 50-watt transmitter into a very poor flat-top type antenna, do you have any feeling about what distance she probably, I mean, it's a guess, but do you have any feeling about
it? I feel that it was considerably less than 100 miles away. Considerably less. And, there has been the only thing is I can think is that she started, if she did say and do that she was running north and south on a line of position, that she's the only one that knew she did, that she was further west of
of what she thought she was at, and she was wasting petrol just running north and south on a line of position that is 60 miles or more west of Howland Island.
Was calling Howland for a cut. Howland reported impossible secure minimum and could not pick up signals on 3105. She's coming in strength 5 and they're not even able to get it. Something's wrong, isn't it?
You mean Howland Island is not being able to get it?
So this is NRE-5-2, yeah. Which is your direction finder on Howland Island.
Yeah. Now, I doubt very much whether we would have used the E, we would have used the letter E.
From.
Yeah. So somebody is playing here. Shall we say the meaning or what have you? Because we would, as radiomen, we would have never used the word cut.
Of course, this is in parentheses.
Yeah.
But they say here they could not pick up the signals on 3105 unless you strength 5 in your radio room.
Now, here's the thing, maybe power has failed on the direction finding receiver at Howland Island. Maybe it got off the frequency, or maybe
unit itself. But let's see what happens here now. Earhart from the last transmission had nearly the same strength as her 758 transmission. The Itasca was laying down a smoke screen stretching for 10 miles. Smoke remained concentrated and did not thin out greatly.
As I remember, the smoke did not. And it stayed up. As I remember, it stayed at a low level rather than plummeting up high.
I see.
But it was really black. And Nelson, as I recall it, the signals continued to build up, not necessarily stayed the same, up until the last transmission.
They got louder and louder all the time.
As I recall it, it seemed to me that the loudest signal was heard was the last transmission.
Okay, let's go to this. Just hold on just a second. Is the tone of her voice, the information that can't be put into a log.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard it. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'd like to talk just for a couple minutes about the messages you did hear from her.
Throughout the time when her signals were readable, it was strictly a professional voice calling and giving the information with no theatrics or inflections up and down. But there was one, maybe it was that message where 30 minutes of people remaining, she could have sounded nervous or saying, what's coming off? Nothing's happening, see? And I rather recall that there was nothing hysterical about it. It was just concern in her voice that didn't show in the other transmissions.
Actually, the other transmissions, she showed practically no concern at all.
It was strictly professional, without any inflections up or down. And what strikes me is all of her transmissions were so brief and giving so little information or showing what her intentions were. That's the thing that struck me at the time, because anybody that had, as I remember, radio operators, they would go to a great extent to find out early in the game, what's wrong here? Why can't we tune you in? Or this, that, and the other thing. But she was just content to transmit on the scheduled times and let it go with that. If she didn't hear anything, why, that was it. And I, since then, of course, have flown an aircraft and whatnot, and I know the concern or that a person should take about radio communications and radio direction findings, and you go after it tooth and nail to get to the bottom of the thing. But I can't recall Mrs. Putnam ever showing anything but cursory interest that communications weren't any better for her than they were. And the other thing that strikes me odd is if she has a radio direction finder aboard, and we have mentioned in our message that we have 500 kilocycles, and I think we also mentioned 375. Now this, if she wanted to go into details, I think in some books it'll show you how much power that we've got. And I believe it was 500 watts, and that's a lot of power to be smacking into the 500 kilocycles, because most of the freighters or oil tankers or whatnot have around 200 watts or less. I think that the main transmitter is 200 watts and the emergency transmitter is around 40 watts. And what it amounts to is if the lady wanted to operate a radio direction finder, she should have been able to hear our